Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Last week, we heard from Benjaphonic talking about the upcoming EP, We Stole Hip Hop. That's out in November. This week, he's back with some bald geek rapping in studio. Also tonight, I'll be speaking with Anthony Parnther, the new conductor and music director for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra, opening their 2019-2020 season with a festive overture by Shostakovich and Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. We're going to start with Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Simon McDermott, author of The Song A Minute Man, a memoir about a man disappearing into Alzheimer's, a temporary reprieve, and a video that went viral.
Today we are speaking with Simon McDermott, author of The Song A Minute Man. All right, Simon, there's more to the title, but I'm not going to go on with that just yet. Okay, because I'd like to talk to you about, first off, the book is a tribute to your father. Will you tell us, please, who is Teddy Mac McDermott, and what was the career he enjoyed so much before Alzheimer's?
Yeah, Dad's been a singer all his life. I mean, from the age of 16, he's been singing. So it's been his passion, really. So, yeah, my dad is a singer, and he's an entertainer. And, yeah. He's all the big band kind of stuff, you know, the kind of Sinatra, the swing, it's kind of, you know, the energetic stuff. He's a powerful singer. He's a good singer as well, so I'm not just saying that. He's a great singer.
Okay. Now, before he became a singer, he held some other jobs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Dad's always done bits of different jobs throughout his life, really, so he hasn't had one regular career. I mean, I'd say my dad is a singer first and foremost.
Okay.
The rest was, you know, he's worked in factories, he's worked on building sites, he's worked as a wood machinist. But like I say, my dad's passion is music, really, and singing.
Okay, now before I move on from the jobs, I'd like to ask you something. What is a Butlin's Red Coat for those of us on this side of the pond?
Yeah, so Butlin's Red Coat is, they're like the people who work in the holiday camps, the entertainers, that used to go around during the day, keep people upbeat. And then in the evenings, they used to do these shows. And yeah, Dad was one of them, really. So he used to, yeah, he's basically entertaining people on holiday, really.
Okay. Okay, so it was still working in the field he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Entertaining is what my dad was passionate about.
Right.
You know, and I don't know why, because he was from a big family. So, I mean, he was the eldest of 14, so I guess part of me thinks, was it because maybe he wanted attention, you know, and that's why he became an entertainer. I don't know, you know, I'll have to speak to a psychologist, but there's a reason why he was always on stage, you know. I think he loved the limelight, you know. But
right.
Also he was good at it, you know. I'm not just saying he was a great entertainer.
Because you're his son and all, yeah.
No, I'm not just saying that because I'm his son. I mean, you know, I'm quite honest, and I think, you know, I think he's a great, when I used to watch his shows when I was a kid, I was like, wow, God, that's amazing, really.
Right.
Yeah, because he would go from one song to the next, and they go, you know. I'm not just saying, I'm not stupid, I know I'm his son, and it's easy for me to say that, but,
right.
You know, people be on the hands applauding, on the feet applauding.
Well, I don't think you really have to worry about that, because you actually have others who are not his sons who think the same thing of your dad, that he was a wonderful entertainer, so you're covered. Okay. Now, I wanted to hold off on the rest of the title, because this is The Song A Minute Man, a tribute to the unbreakable bond between father and son. And the reason why I held off is because your dad, before his affliction, you and he had a great relationship together. And I was wondering, how did your dad influence your life and the lives of those he touched before Alzheimer's?
Well, do you know what, actually? Me and my dad didn't have a great relationship. We were quite distant and very, like, chalk and cheese. When I was very young, we were very close, you know. But I think, obviously, in teenage years, you drift apart from your father, in a way, I guess. And, you know, you are quite different. It's only now, through dementia and on reflection of what Dad was like and writing the book and speaking to people about who knew my dad, and also my own memories, that I realized, you know, He was a kind guy. He was always looking out for people, you know. I was always brought up to treat everybody the same, no matter who they were or wherever they came from. That was a big thing for me. You know, I mean, I remember when I was really young, was a kid on the street where I lived, and he had ginger hair, and he got bullied. And as soon as my dad found out about that, you know, God, I had a good idea in that day, because, you know, the whole thing is, we're all together in this, you know. And I think that's also him being part of a big family, you know, that, you know, we're all, you know, everybody's treated the same,
right.
Really. So that's what I've, from growing up, really, I've always, yeah, that's my dad's, what my dad taught me, really.
Okay, because I gathered from the way you wrote this that you always had an admiration for him, no matter what.
No, I wouldn't say that. No, I mean,
no.
I love my dad, and
we were close,
obviously. But when I say my teenage years, we were very different. You know,
right.
Dad was the entertainer. I was completely quiet. You know, very shy, very different. Really, it's only as you know, as you become an adult and you become a man and you can reflect on things that you think, oh, actually, yeah, you know, you start to you have the admiration, you know, and the things that my dad did. You know, and the actual courage that he had to do things, you know, for him to go across the county and then turn up at a club on his own and do a show, you know, that takes a lot of guts, which I took for granted when I was a kid, you know?
Okay. Well, I think most teenagers actually do the same thing. But I could see, as you wrote and the things that you guys were going through, that you did have some reflection and you had some admiration for him, because that did come through. But now...
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, now, on hindsight, I have a lot of admiration for my dad. But at the time, mm-hmm. I didn't. He was just dad, you know?
Right. Now, how did he touch the lives of those he entertained before Alzheimer's? Because I understand there were a lot of people who thought he was just a wonderful entertainer.
He was, yeah. I mean, like, it's funny, because when I was growing up, he always used to tell people that there used to be people around the block queuing to see him. And I thought, oh, he's just exaggerating, you know. But then, obviously, writing the book, I got in contact with his old bandmates, and he said to me, he said, your dad changed my life, you know. And he said we had to bundle him out the back of a club because there'd be women literally throwing themselves at him.
Wow.
And, yeah, and I was like, wow, all these stories, he was telling the truth, you know. And I didn't realize, you know, it's only... Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? You know what life throws at you.
Yes, it is. Now, in 2013, Teddy Mac was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. What was the immediate effect upon your dad, your family, and upon you after receiving that information?
Initially, it was relief, because then we knew what was going on, you know, and we could give a name to it, because we were living with Dad's aggression. When I say the aggression was off the scale, it was off the scale. And then the violence, you know, Dad was never violent. He would fly off the handle if he was angry, but not to the extent that we were getting I was frightened for my safety, and I was terrified for Mum's safety,
right?
You know, so yeah.
Now, as the disease progressed, what were the effects upon your dad, your family, and you? Because you guys had to learn how, once you had the information, you had to learn how to adapt and still love him and, you know, work with him.
Yeah. I think every day, I think the whole thing with Alzheimer's is every day is a different day. You know, it's as soon as you get used to one thing, it changes, and then you've got to relearn it again. So you're always on your toes, really.
Right.
I've described before that it's kind of like I've learned to step into Dad's dimension in a way, because... his reality is completely different to our reality, really.
Right.
And the way of calming him down and making him feel okay and assured that he's not alone is by stepping into that dimension, which is sometimes completely crazy.
Wow.
You know?
Now, your dad is known as the Song a Minute Man. How did he come to be known as that?
So, basically, it was his nickname when he used to do all the clubs. So, like, when he was on the stage... they used to introduce him as the Song a Minute Man because of all the different songs that he knew. I mean, he knew his repertoire goes back from like the 30s to the 20s, you know, all the way up to, you know, modern stuff. But he's like, because it was funny because he knew so many songs, but then when I was writing the book and I was speaking to my aunties, and they said that he used to go down to a record shop every week when he was 16 or whatever. And he used to get like records from America. Like now and again, he'd find like really bizarre records, whatever. And also, he'd be the first one to get the music from America, and he'd take that to the pub on the Saturday. So in the afternoon, he'd learn that song, so he'd be the first person in Wolverhampton to know the song, you know.
Wow.
That had just come out in America. And he was for him, it was always like he had to be the first one to be able to sing that song. So he was, you know, he was he was really, when I say he's really passionate about it, it was his passion, really. So,
right. Now, I'd like to take a moment, Simon, and give you some time to share with our audience where they can find out more information about your book and also about the video that you made with your dad singing that touched so many people's lives.
Yeah, so obviously the book's out now in all good bookshops, or you can get it from Amazon. But if you want to find more information just about the story, about what we've been doing, the best place is probably facebook.com, Song a Minute. Or if you just Google Song a Minute, there's loads of things there. Or it's on YouTube and it's on Twitter. So there's lots of sites.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, how has the music and the songs your dad loved so much helped in this trying time? What inspired you to make the video heard around the world?
Do you know what? It wasn't being inspired to make a video that went to go around the world. It was purely a video for me and my mum, right. Really. And I put it on Facebook with a link to a fundraising page, and people started to share it. There was no plan. There was no plan of, like, I want to turn this to something viral at all. In a way, I think on hindsight, maybe I did think it was kind of like, right, Dad, because you know, I knew that Dad was disappearing. It was kind of like, this is the last chance to show off your voice. You know,
right.
Maybe part of me thought that, I don't know. But there was no plan at all. There really wasn't a plan.
Right.
It really wasn't.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a plan. But since you put it there, you've had great response to this video. And you've had to have a lot of people who are going through this contact you or try to contact you. And what have they been telling you? I mean, is it just thank you, or do they identify with what you're going through? How has that worked out?
Yeah, it was thousands of messages. I think a lot of people are like pour their heart out and like really long messages, and you realize how alone people are in this situation and what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm grateful for, you know, people tell me their story, and I'm like, wow, I'm so grateful I'm not in the same situation.
Wow.
But I've got like messages. Yeah, I've got some messages from like from women with. I have sons or daughters with, like, learning difficulties or Asperger's or things like that. There's this one woman that wrote to me, and she said, thank you. She said her son was at Asperger's, and he wouldn't communicate. And then she played him the Kwando video, and now he goes around the house singing Kwando, and he tells people at school that his favorite song is Kwando. And she said, thank you. She said, I couldn't find a way of connecting to him, and I've connected with – he suddenly started singing this song. And I was like, wow.
Right.
You know, that was – it was quite emotional. I'd say it's been a really emotional journey for me, really. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really curious about the journey for you. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, like, it sounds really corny, but I think it's been quite spiritual,
huh?
Really. I think, you know, I think when all this was going on, I think, you know, in my 40s, I was probably thinking, you know, what am I doing with my life and blah, blah, blah. What does it all mean? And then, you know, Alzheimer's hit. And then you realize, actually, the only thing that matters is just being happy with your family and people that you love, you know? That's
right.
All that matters. It doesn't matter how big your house is or your car or whatever. As long as you're with people that you enjoy being with, that's the most important thing.
Wow. How did you find this way of connecting with your dad as far as the music goes? How did you, you know, stumble upon this?
How did I stumble on it? As long as my dad was happy and smiling,
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to do more of it. As long as my dad wasn't attacking me. That's why we did it, really. How did I find it? It was a release, you know. It was a moment of light that we could. It was a break from the aggression, really.
Wow. Well, this is really such a great book, The Song of Minute Man, a tribute to the unbreakable bond between father and son, because we don't often think of bonds between father and sons these days. I mean, not as much as we should. So I want to thank you for that. What do you hope those listening and those reading your book will take away from hearing of the personal experience you have been sharing?
There's always hope. No matter what there is, no matter how dark the day is, there's always hope, you know. There's always a chink of light. You just got to aim for it. I think that's the main thing.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with author Simon McDermott. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Last week we heard from Ben Jafonik talking about the upcoming EP We Stole Hip Hop. This week he's back with some bald geek rapping in the KVCR studios. First, though, Anthony Parther, the new conductor and music director for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra. Their 2019-2020 season opens with the festive overture by Shostakovich and Carl Orff's Carmina Burana in its entirety. Anthony, this is quite a milestone, if I may quote the press release I got. This is your 10th year not only as music director of the Southeast Symphony in L.A., but now we're also looking at you for our region as musical director of the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra. We'll be looking at some of your history and then looking at the season. For the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra, the season will be kicking off with Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. And this is just really a great excuse for me to have that playing while we speak. Also the festival overture from Shostakovich. But first, a little bit about you, please. It was in grade school elsewhere in Virginia when you actually started music, and it was an instrumental music program, I should point out.
Yes, I actually came to the bassoon rather late. I started playing the bassoon in the 9th grade. The actual story is that I joined the band so that I could go on the trips to Disney World and Busch Gardens. You know, I would be in math class, for instance, and I'd hear over the intercom what all of the members of the band report to the buses for their trip to King's Dominion or Busch Gardens or all these places that I wanted to go that my parents definitely would not have taken me. So I connived the plan with a couple of my friends who were in this thing called band. So I opened the dictionary, the A section, and I saw the accordion. You know, in the A section, I saw the picture of the accordion, and I remember watching, you know, rather reluctantly, the Lawrence Welk show with my parents as a kid. And the accordion did not appeal to me, you know?
No, he wasn't the coolest looking guy up there, yeah.
From my remembrances of the Lawrence Welk show. But I turned over to the B section of the dictionary, and I saw the bassoon, and I was like, oh, that'll do. So I literally took the dictionary to the high school band and a little check for $25 to rent one, and I learned to play it over the summer, and ta-da, I was a bassoon player by the beginning of my 9th grade year, and I was absolutely awful first year. But that's literally how I got my start in music, is I wanted to go to the theme parks with my friends, and I figured that if it was mandated by the school band program, then, you know, I would have to go. So that's how I got my start.
That is quite excellent. I was really going to ask you about why the bassoon. Tim Weisberg, for example, ended up with a flute because his name starts with a W, and they got to choose according to alphabetizing of the name. Well, now, beyond the bassoon, though, I had really almost dismissed why the bassoon when I saw that you also specialize in some very not-so-common, also woodwind instruments. We've got the sarrusophone and the heckelphone. These are, you know, so not well-known. If you wouldn't mind describing these, I could say one looks like brass, but it's a double reed. The other one is a relative of the oboe, just an octave lower. Could you give the audience a better description, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for instance, you know, you mentioned the sarrusophone. Back in the 1860s, there were three instrument inventors who were all competing to introduce a new instrument to the orchestra. And you had Roth, who created the Rothophone. You had Sarrus, who created a series of metal instruments called the sarrusophones. And then you heard of this little guy named Adolf Sax, who created the saxophones. And the Rothophones became immediately unpopular. The sound just wasn't very flexible. The instruments were somewhat poorly constructed. And then the sort of competition kind of narrowed down between the sarrusophone family, which is a series of double reed metallic instruments, and these single reed metallic instruments that were made by Adolf Sax. So if you take a look at some of the repertoire from the turn of the century, like late 1800s, early 1900s, you'll see that composers like Paul Dukas and Ravel actually used the sarrusophone, especially the contrabass sarrusophone, as a supplementary instrument for the contrabassoon. So just like the saxophone comes in many keys from soprano all the way down to bass.
Sure.
The sarrusophone comes in the same sort of key signatures. You know, you have your little soprano sarrusophones and you have these contrabass sarrusophones. But the saxophone is the instrument that ultimately won out. But, you know, the sarrusophone, you know, especially the bass and contrabass sarrusophone, are kind of like French marching bassoons in a military band. They were used quite widely in the military bands for quite a while. But again, they sort of fell into disfavor. But it's an interesting sound. It's kind of like a mixture of the saxophone and the bassoon. And for some of the composers that explored for. They're always looking for new sounds to explore. And the Heckelphone is a member, really, of the oboe family. You know, so the oboe itself, there's a little soprano oboe, the oboe de mor, which is a slightly longer oboe than the English horn, which is like an alto oboe. And then there's the bass oboe. But the Heckelphone is basically kind of like an enhanced bass oboe. So it's an octave below the oboe, and it was used predominantly, again, at the turn of the century to sort of expand the oboe voice into the lower register. And it was used in a lot of works like the Alpine Symphony. It was used in The Planets by Holst. So that's where the Heckelphone comes from. It's a really exotic sound. It's absolutely gorgeous. So, yeah, I play all the weird, like nearly obsolete woodwind instruments in addition to, you know, bassoon.
How did you end up with these very off-the-wall, for lack of a better way of putting it, instruments, the two that we were just speaking of there?
I think it was a curiosity. You know, I just saw a picture in the Grove Dictionary many years ago that showed, like, the double reed family. And, of course, I thought, okay, oboe, English horn, bassoon, contrabassoon. And I was like, what are these instruments? And, you know, so I always had a curiosity about the sarrusophone family. I was like, where do you find one of these things? They're very rare and hard to come by. And I happened to run into one online. You know, they were selling one on eBay. So I was like, well, I absolutely must have this.
Yeah.
So I actually have quite a vast woodwind instrument collection. I have basically all of the standard orchestral instruments, you know, from piccolo all the way down to bass flute and E-flat clarinet all the way down to contrabass clarinet. So I pretty much own all of the orchestral wind instruments, and then I started to collect the more obsolete ones, probably starting about 15 years ago.
Cool. Well, it's great to not only have them as part of an interesting collection, but the fact that you do actually play them, that's really cool, I have to say. You, I understand, serve as the Artistic Director of Musicians at Play, and I'd like for you to explain what this is, please.
Musicians at Play, have you heard of a composer by the name of John Williams?
Yes, his son was the third lead singer for Toto, but people know him for other reasons, but yeah.
Exactly. Well, his brother is a legendary studio percussionist and somebody that I've worked with over the last decade. So Don Williams, the percussionist, and his wife, April, started the Musicians at Play Foundation to do a couple of things. One thing that they do is they raise money for instrumental music programs, beginning in Burbank, where their family got their start, but they're rapidly expanding that. So what they brought me in to do a number of years ago was to give these young deserving orchestral students an opportunity to play with the principals from John Williams' orchestra that he records with here in Hollywood when he's recording his soundtracks. So you have like a young cellist who's sitting next to Armin Shajikian, who has performed on every John Williams score going all the way back to E.T. Or a violinist who's sitting next to Roger Wilkie, who is John Williams' concertmaster. So this is really the only place in the entire country where kids get the opportunity to play a John Williams score with me conducting alongside the very musicians who have recorded these scores over the last 30 or 40 years. So it's an amazing educational opportunity for the kids, and it's also an opportunity for them to raise quite a bit of money to keep instrumental music in the schools thriving. And I'm dedicated to the education of young ones, and this is one of the ways that I've tried to remain involved in music education.
That's quite beautiful. It really sounds almost like a full immersion master's class, Musicians at Play.
That's exactly it, because all of the students get to take sectionals with all of these esteemed musicians, and then they get to play, you know, the music of John Williams right next to the very musicians who've recorded it. And so Don Williams is the person who really put all of that together and talked his colleagues into getting involved. So it's a really unforgettable experience for them, and it's a real privilege for me to get to conduct John's music with, you know, his brother and the top third of his recording orchestra playing there.
Oh my gosh, I would imagine so. Now, Anthony, I'm going to name a bunch of names here. Jackie Evancho, Beyonce, Kanye West, Hanson, Snoop Dogg, Madonna, Michael Bolton, Pete Townsend, Billy Idol, Vanessa Williams, Maynard Ferguson, there we go, also Wynton Marsalis, Doc Severinsen, and Stevie Wonder. You, I think, are the only common element with all of these folks. And so, my God, we'll hit a few of these, but what I want to point out really is that your collaborations are so vast And not only, obviously, by the names that I just mentioned, not only folks known in the classical, or I should say orchestral world, but also things like Cirque de la Symphonie, which we'll have later this season, but Kanye West and Wu-Tang Clan. Can you tell me how a person such as yourself, Kanye is maybe the last thing that I would think of for a lot of things, but especially with the bassoon or classical works, and Wu-Tang Clan. Can we talk about these couple of things?
Yeah, working on that particular side of the industry began around, I can't remember the exact year, but it was either 2013 or 2014. I was called up because the artist Rihanna was looking for a 50-piece African-American orchestra accompanying her at the American Music Awards, actually. You can find this online. And so I was called to assist in contracting an orchestra for that. I was a natural person to call because I've conducted the Southeast Symphony for many years now, and that's the oldest predominantly African-American orchestra in the United States. So it began there. So ever since I worked with Rihanna on that first project, several other opportunities to work on that side of the musical continuum happened, including, you know, working with Kanye West and working with RZA and Wu-Tang Clan. And it's been very interesting to watch how musical artists operate in rehearsal, operate in the recording studio, and how they interact with their fans and their fan base. And it's been a real learning experience for me. These artists are not there by accident. They are extremely efficient, extremely detail-oriented. And regardless of what you've seen in the media, all of these artists are absolute dears to work with. I mean, they're real sweethearts. And yeah, so it's been a really fruitful set of collaborations. I worked with RZA on a Chipotle commercial. We did the recordings with the full orchestra at Capitol Records using room A and B combined. There's a divider between the rooms, so we put the winds and the brass and room B and the strings and woodwinds in room A and just kind of have this giant room. So yeah, these have been a really wonderful collaboration. So I have come up a number of times as that guy who helps add classical elements to any genre of music.
Cool. Well, another one that I kind of really have to mention, we got John Williams out of the way there, so now I'll go with Danny Elfman. And folks would know of Danny Elfman through perhaps The Simpsons theme, or Oingo Boingo, or with collaborations with Tim Burton. And with the latter in mind, there's such a darkness combined with a quirkiness with the Elfman-Burton works. And now, knowing that you may work with him again, is that a fair way to sum up Danny, or working with him? Darkness combined with quirkiness here.
I definitely think so. You know, my opportunities to work with Danny Elfman has been as a bassoonist and contrabassoonist. Of course, I've conducted a number of his works over the years, but I think one of the very first projects that I can recall working with Danny on was the soundtrack to Goosebumps movie. And one of the more recent things that I got to do is that we musicians, you know, members of the Hollywood Studio Symphony got to preview and sight read his most recent Violin Concerto, which really very interesting work. So we got to sort of preview that at Warner Brothers, if I remember correctly. You know, so it's been really interesting as a musician to watch him expand beyond film scoring and onto concert music. So that's really exceptional.
Oh my God, yes, yes. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Anthony Parnther, the new music director and conductor for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra. More on the symphony, including their September 14th concert, at sanbernardinosymphony.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, we hear once again from Ben Jafonik performing in studio one of the tunes from the upcoming EP We Stole Hip Hop. First, though, back to Anthony Parnther, conductor and music director for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra. They'll be opening their 2019-2020 season with the festive overture by Shostakovich and Carl Orff's Carmina Burana. It's mentioned on this press release that your bassoon can be heard prominently with the Kominsky Method. This is a Netflix thing. And also on Spike Lee's Black Klansman.
Yeah, well, you know, the Kominsky Method on Netflix, and the stars of that are Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. And, you know, it's really about people who are in the sunsets of their careers. And, you know, I was called in by the composer Jeff Cardone to come to his studio, and really kind of like the voice, sort of like the theme of the Kominsky Method, the voice that he thought that was kind of perfect for this really sort of like quirky, dark comedy / drama. You know, there's a lot of dramatic and comedic elements that coinciding throughout the entire series was the bassoon. Yeah, so the bassoon is kind of like an element that you hear throughout the entire series, both interstitially and thematically. I forgot that I worked on the Kominsky Method, and then I was watching the show because, you know, it got a lot of really good press, and then I heard myself, and I was like, that's me.
Nice, nice.
But, yeah, so that was a really interesting project, and I believe it's been renewed for a second season, so
hopefully
I'll get to work on it.
Did you recognize it right away, or were you by chance criticizing the bassoonist before you went, oh, no, wait, that's me?
I did kind of look, and I was like, well, that's a very similar concept to what I probably would have, oh, wait a minute, that's me.
Cool, way cool. Now, before going on to the San Bernardino Symphony, just really a couple more things. You are seen as an authority on orchestral works by minority and women composers. So when we talk about you restoring and performing some of these works, performing, okay, that's obvious, but what are we talking about regarding restoration of certain works?
There are a number of composers that come to mind. Florence Price, for instance, you know, she's the first black woman to have her works played by a major orchestra. The Chicago Symphony performed her symphony in E minor back in the 1930s. However, there are a number of composers who have libraries and volumes and bodies of music, but these bodies of music are sometimes and often scattered in a sense of disarray. They're sketches, they're disorganized. So with Florence Price, for instance, I've spent quite a lot of time over the last 20 years identifying sketches of music that she has assembled, and I've been kind of trying to fill in the dotted lines and restore some of these works. One work that I've been involved in restoring and bringing to life is a work called The Oaks, which is a tone poem she wrote, we believe, in the 1940s, and it's been performed twice. But it's like taking these scores that are in really, really, really bad shape and recopying these scores so that they're visible and sort of, you know, if an E natural is like faded, okay, making sure that you sort of have Florence Price's sensibilities as a musician and figuring out that, yes, that is an E major chord here, and really filling in all the cracks as best you can, because there are some of these works that are just in a terrible state of disarray. Another work that I've been involved in is Wawa House by Zenobia Powell Perry, which is an opera that she wrote. Zenobia Powell Perry is really one of the unsung heroes as far as women composers and black composers, and only now, after her death, are her works really starting to gain traction because people are beginning to realize that this woman was an absolute genius. So, yeah, I have a long history of trying to provide a platform for underrepresented composers, whether they be female or minority females, to have their music heard. There was an interesting study that was by the Baltimore Symphony a few years ago that examined that in the greatest 22 concert halls in America, that less than 2% of the music that was being programmed were by women composers. Now, I ask you, of that less than 2%, how many of those women do you think were black women? So I have given the premieres of works by, I think, over 45 black female composers.
Oh,
I'm probably one of the few people on earth who can name 45 black composers, but they are out there, and I've been an active advocate for getting these important works premiered and performed and commissioned and things along those lines. I recently went to England, and I recorded on the NMC label works by Erlyn Wallen. Erlyn Wallen is the first black woman to have her works performed at the proms, at the BBC proms. We recorded a piece by Philip Herbert and a number of other Afro-British composers. This is a lifelong passion of mine, and it's been a very rewarding project to give these works performances and premieres and restoration.
I would imagine. You've got, as a conductor, you have the perfect vehicle to be able to do such a thing. That's truly incredible. let's actually look at the season, or at least the first portions of the season. We've got Danny Elfman coming up. This is the second concert, but this first one. Now, earlier we mentioned Carmina Burana, and I suppose if people know Carmina Burana, and they probably do because it's just used so many places, they know the O Fortuna portion or movement of it, epic battle scenes or a really good Chevrolet commercial probably. This is quite a way to kick off your season as the new conductor for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra. You are the one that picks the season, right?
A majority of the first season was assembled by the Artistic Planning Committee because they had to pick a season before they decided who was going to be the new music director. So this first season was a bit of a collaboration. So there are things in the first season that I have chosen, and there are things that were chosen before a music director was selected. So I think we found a very good balance for the entire season, and it's going to be a really exciting series. Yeah, it starts off with one of the most epic works written for orchestra, Carmina Burana. So I am really excited to conduct this work again. This will be my fourth time conducting Carmina Burana, and it's been a different experience each time.
And this has the Los Robles Master Chorale in this. And you have to, because this is one of those, I don't know how many voices are generally involved. I always describe it as, 50, 60, 70 voices. You know, I don't know really what it is, but is this going to be the full work, Carmina Burana, or the known movements from it?
Yeah, we are doing all 25 movements, which occupies usually about 60 to 70 minutes. So it'll be the second half of our program. Yes, so we are using the Los Robles Master Chorale. I understand they're bringing 90 singers.
Mm.
A very, very crowded stage.
My gosh.
This piece requires a big orchestra, a big choir, three soloists, and a conductor. So there's going to be a lot of activity going on up there.
I didn't realize that saying 90, that's not an exaggeration. My gosh. Wow. The performance starts off with a work by Shostakovich. This is the festive overture. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece historically, where it originally came from? Maybe I should better state why it came to be.
The festive overture, written by Shostakovich, I believe in 1946 or 1947, and it was written to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the October Revolution, but the performance ended up getting delayed a number of years. So I don't think it was actually first performed until perhaps maybe the mid-1950s. Shostakovich is a composer who has been the subject of much throughout his career, but this is not a work that has any alternate agendas. It's really just a virtuosic, celebratory work that has two fanfares and a lot of technical material in between. This is one of his very straightforward works that's purely celebratory in nature, but it's also very difficult. It is not an easy work to pull off. It is 6 minutes of really amplified brass, sprinting woodwinds and strings, incredibly intricate rhythms. So it's a tour de force for any orchestra to sort of undertake.
This opening of the 2019-2020 season for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra, I guess just huge is the best way to describe it, between Carmina Burana and the work by Shostakovich. The next one, we've got some Danny Elfman, Nightmare Before Christmas, and Tchaikovsky, portions from the Nutcracker. This is, I guess, a combination of your choosing and the board before you were brought on?
That's correct. The Artistic Planning Committee really wanted to do their best to come up with a concert that sort of highlighted the holiday season. There's a little bit of everything sort of chalked into there. The interesting thing about this concert, well, there's many interesting things about this concert, but the most interesting thing about this concert is that we don't have just one sort of luminary. We have two luminaries from two different musical genres performing on the same concert. You know, in the first half, one of the most legendary cellists alive, one of the most highly respected cellists living, and Lynn Harrell, who will be performing the work of Ernst Bloch, his Shlomo Hebraic Rhapsody. So he'll be performing on the front half of the program, and then on the second half of the program, we have a Broadway legend, Jennifer Holliday,
yes,
performing on the second half. You know, we know her from Dreamgirls on Broadway, where she won a Tony for that, and she's a multiple award-winning icon of Broadway and soul and gospel music. This is really unusual for any orchestra to have two artists of this caliber performing on the same program. So I am really, really looking forward to working with both of these artists. They're two artists that I've respected and admired my entire life, and finally I'm getting the opportunity to work with face to face.
we will definitely get you back in to talk about, oh, the tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. and Cirque de la Symphonie and all this other wonderful big stuff that we have, the Tchaikovsky and the stage to screen later in the year. Before we close out, I want to return to something from your past, and it can't be haunting you too much because there's a picture of it smack dab on your website. I'm speaking about dead Elvis, okay? Yeah, you know it. I mean, you go to your website and you see a picture of a guy who looks like Elvis circa 74, 5, or 6, the sideburns and the glasses and the white jumpsuit, except, how shall I say it? It's a black guy and he's holding a bassoon, okay?
Yeah, dead Elvis is such a fun performance. It's in the actual performance note that the performer is to wear an Elvis costume while performing this work. Yes, you know, the instrumentation is the exact instrumentation as the Stravinsky work, and oftentimes it's paired on the same program. But yes, I was asked to perform that work with the California State Los Angeles faculty. The faculty was doing a chamber concert, and they invited me to be the guest soloist for that work, and it's a super, super difficult, virtuosic bassoon solo work, but it's a lot of fun for the audience. I mean, it took the audience about 5 minutes just to stop laughing so we could begin performance. It's a real coup, and something that I'll probably do again. Hopefully I can afford a better wig.
I hope so. So the audience is laughing anyway. Do you end up with the Elvis strut, the Elvis hand gesture, which I think Gene Simmons may be trying to copyright, you know, all this kind of Elvis-related stuff? Or are you just up there with a bassoon? You just happen to be dressed like him. Any other schlock thrown in there?
Oh, it's very, very humorous. Everything about it is definitely sort of a humorous gesture, but respectful. You know, it's a contemporary work that mixes in Elvis's most famous themes, and sometimes they appear out of nowhere. And so the whole thing really, there's shtick to it. So yeah, it's definitely unapologetically a humorous work, and I have no problem getting in the spirit of shtick if I must.
We just heard from Anthony Parther, conductor and music director for the San Bernardino Symphony Orchestra, opening their 2019-2020 season, September 14th. More at sanbernardinosymphony.org. Now, before we close out another edition of KVC Arts, we have a brief return of Benjaphonic. He was in studio last week talking about the upcoming EP, We Stole Hip Hop. This week, he's back with one of the tracks from the upcoming EP, performed with his entourage, here in the KVCR studios.
This one's for reals, yo. Yo, David, you want me to bust you a rhyme right now?
Do it.
All right, yo, this is about you. This is gonna be a letter from my mama to you.
Check it.
What? Rhymes are so fast, they call me supersonic. The rhymes are so slow,
can't keep up with Benjaphonic.
My music is dope, they're calling it the chronic. Your music's a joke, man, they call it
milk and tonic.
My beats are so fat, they call me
Master Blaster.
Your beats are so flat, they call you hip hop
disaster. Come on, it's time for a brand new precious rhyme.
Yo. My mama said you're a sucker, MC. My mama said you're a sucker. Oh, you know what? I'm sorry, but my mama, she's a mean lady.
Check it.
My riggedy brother,
so funky. They call me Superfly.
You look like a junkie. They call you Family Guy. My style is off the hook. They call me
Rap Delicious.
Your style is in the book listed.
Rapper Unambitious.
My grooves are so fresh. They call me
Bollywood Bionic.
The grooves of Bangladesh.
Third world to Benjaphonic. Come on, it's time.
What time is it?
For a brand new precious rhyme.
My mama said you're a sucker MC. My mama said you're a sucker MC.
My mama said you're a sucker MC.
My rap is suboptimal, anyone can see that your style's gone flat. Your beat's not fat. You ain't rocking no Adidas or a Kango hat. Time to learn from the pro, the true rhyme master,
the supersonic, Benjaphonic, master blaster.
You a sucker MC.
Well, that's what time it is. My mama said you're a sucker MC. My mama said you're a sucker MC.
You show me yours, and I'ma show you mine.
My mama said you're a sucker MC. My mama said you're a sucker.
That cougar yell is from my mama.
My mama said you're a sucker MC.
She's a beast of an animal.
That's Ben Jafonik and company in studio with Braggadocious Rhyme. That's one of the tracks from the upcoming EP, We Soul Hip Hop. More on benjafonik.com. That's BenjaphonikDotcom. Also a very entertaining look and presence on Facebook. And if you missed last week's KVC Arts, it was all Ben Jafonik, checking out each track from the upcoming EP. You can find that and all past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, many past shows are on iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play. You can also now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Thanks once again to Ben Jafonik, a.k.a. Ben Stewart, Anthony Parther, and collectively, let's say the 90 voices bringing us Carmina Burana September 14th. Again, more on that at sanbernardinosymphony.org. Thanks also to Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Simon McDermott, author of The Song A Minute Man. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wad, and Natalie Calmer. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.